Yeah, I'm going to talk about some things pretty much that I did in my PhD, although some things I've done a bit later. Most of this is done in collaboration with my PhD supervisor, who is Paul Bush, Professor Paul Bush in York. And some of the more recent ideas have come from collaboration with Takayuki Miyadera in Kyoto. The work primarily has been published in these two locations, and there are various, hopefully upcoming, on the things that I'm going to talk about towards the end of my talk, but I'd say three quarters of it is contained in these two papers. So the talk is framed within the language of quantum measurement theory, or at least the first two-thirds or so will be. So that the talk's going to start with just a really brief introduction to that subject, just the bare bones. And then I'll get onto the brunt of it in sort of sections 3 and 4, which is limitations to quantum measurements due to conservation laws, and the generalization to the case of position measurements, which was not covered by the original proofs of the theorem that I'm going to present to you. And then, hopefully there'll be time, I'm sure there will be, I'm going to talk about reference systems or reference frames, which I think have a natural role in the subject that I'm going to discuss of conservation law induced limitations to quantum measurements. So hopefully I can convince you of that. And then there's a interesting correspondence with the subject of superselection rules, which I'll talk about right at the end in a very brief fashion. I'm not going to say too much about it, partly because I know there are experts in the room who know more about this than me, and partly just because it's kind of a natural ending to the main thrust of the talk. So as we know, in physics in general and in quantum mechanics in particular, measurements aren't perfect. There are inaccuracies. I've split them into two categories, although I'm in no way suggesting that these can't interact in some way. I think I was just attracted by the symmetry of having four in each. So broadly speaking, there are practical or technological limitations to measurements, bad equipment resolution, difficulty of implementation for quantum logic gates or whatever in quantum computation. And then the second two, I guess, could go in the fundamental category too, small numbers of measurements available to us, and decoherence that actually happens in the lab. And then there are those which are sort of derived from the basic textbook description itself. So uncertainty relations for joint measurements of non-commuting observables. What I'll call intrinsic unsharpness, this is going to come up later. There are positive operator valued measures in quantum mechanics representing observables which have no sharp counterpart. So the spin phase, phase conjugate to spin, is one example of such a thing. So that's a fundamentally quantum limitation to accuracy, or to measurements at least. And then the two that I'm going to focus on primarily, which are conservation laws and superselection rules. And it's the reason I've included the term measurability up here is precisely because I'm going to be talking about superselection rules, because you can't really talk about inaccurate measurements of observables or of operators that don't commute with a superselected quantity, because they're not observable at all, at least in the standard formulation. So I'll just start with some notation. It's going to be slightly fiddly at the beginning, but it's going to get better. So I'm going to be working with positive operator valued measures as the definition of quantum observables. I'll motivate that in a minute. But just for the introduction, we have this pair is some set, and F is some sigma algebra of subsets of omega that forms a measurable space. And a normalized POVM is just an assignment to each element of the sigma algebra, a positive operator in some Hilbert space, and it satisfies some extra conditions. Normalization, so that probability is always adds up to one, and this additivity here, and if you're talking in infinite dimensional settings, then there has to be some appropriate convergence, strong or weak would do. And I'll talk about the pair omega F as the value space of the POVM. You can think of it as just the set of outcomes of measurements of the POVM E. This will become clear, hopefully. So I'll refer to E of X as effects, or probably sometimes POVM elements. And the virtue of this definition, or the importance of the definition, is that this assignment of elements of F to elements in the interval 0, 1 is a probability measure if and only if E is a POVM. So in that sense, POVMs saturate the full sort of probabilistic structure of quantum mechanics, which is why I'm going to talk about observables as being normalized POVMs. Often, this pair, I'm going to suppress a lot of the dependence later, but it'll either just be the real numbers and the Borel sets of the real numbers, or just some discrete set and its power set will be the sigma algebra that I'm talking about. And of course, if E of X is a projection for every X, then we have the full machinery of the spectral theorem, and this integral defines and is defined by a unique self-adjoint operator. So there's a one-to-one correspondence between the projection valued measure and self-adjoint operators, and we recover the sort of normal textbook description. So that's just the setting of what I'm going to be talking about. So now we can do some physics. So within quantum measurement theory, we have some quantum system that we want to learn about, and it's represented by a Hilbert space, H. And the apparatus, the measuring apparatus, is also treated within the quantum mechanical formalism. So it has its own Hilbert space, K. And the game is to dream up a unitary or a unitary group, I've suppressed the parameter, that entangles and correlates the system that you're investigating with the apparatus that you have access to as an experimenter. And the better you can make those correlations, the better your measurement's gonna be. So that's the unitary part. We need a fixed unit vector phi in the Hilbert space of the apparatus. Physically, that's just your ready-to-go state when you're doing a measurement. It crops up in a mathematical context too. I'll talk about that in the next slide. But it's just some fixed unit vector in K, that's all. We can do this too for density matrices, but it's just easier if it's pure. And we need a pointer observable, Z. So this is the observable that we actually read. So we do a measurement, the pointer moves to some position, and we read it off from the apparatus. So I'll call EZ its spectral measure, and just for convenience, I'm gonna assume it has the same outcome space as the observable that we're trying to measure. That's just a convenience assumption. So the point is that we've now fixed this list of an apparatus Hilbert space, a unitary coupling, a ready-to-go state of the apparatus, and a pointer observable that we're going to read out the values of the measurement from. So the final thing we need for a measurement, or I say measurement scheme, but I'm going to keep saying measurement. This is just ingrained. Is this relation one? And what this is saying is that the final, the spectral measure, so the probability distribution is the best way to think of it. The probability distribution for the pointer observable in the final state of the system and apparatus combined is exactly given by the statistics of the initial, or of all states of the system you're investigating. So this is a transcription of statistics, essentially, from the system that you're investigating to the apparatus that you have access to. So it's really a measurement theoretic version of the Born rule, is how you can think of this condition. And there are two readings of condition one. One of them is that you fix the observable that you're trying to measure, E, it's a POVM, and the measurement scheme, M, is just a Neimark dilation of E. That's one reading. And the benefit of viewing it this way is that every observable has a measurement. So that's good. It means we can measure any POVM we choose by just this really minimal set of requirements. But the other way around, please ask questions, by the way, if you have any. Yeah. The other way around, and this is the way that it often crops up, actually, when you're dealing with specific models, is that you choose some unitary. So you choose U, and you fix what your apparatus is, and then you can tinker with the observable that you want to measure on the apparatus to get a better measurement of E. So you choose some convenient Hamiltonian that you can solve, maybe, and you ask how good a measurement can we actually do. And then what equation one does is fixes E uniquely. So you fix this list of four things, this measurement scheme, and you choose your pointer and your unitary, and this fixes the measured observable. So if you choose badly, you'll get something trivial or close to trivial. If you choose well, you'll get something that's really close to maybe what you actually wanted to measure. So I'll call the measurement accurate if E is projection valued. That's possibly a slight abuse of language, but usually we want to measure projection valued measures, so self-adjoint operators. So I'm going to keep to this just because it keeps things simpler. So a condition that comes up in the quantum theory of measurement and in quantum mechanics in general is the repeatability of a measurement. So this can be formulated in precisely the same language as what I've just presented, but it's easier just to think of it in words. And it's just the standard thing. So a repeatable measurement is one in which you can do your measurement and then do it again immediately afterwards and get the same result with probability one. So this is a standard assumption in a lot of textbooks, but I see no reason why it should be in there. There are plenty of physical reasons why I think you shouldn't believe that repeatability is a necessity. There are plenty of measurements where this is violated. And obviously within the measurement theory that I've just presented, it's certainly not implied by the probability reproducibility condition or anything like that. So we're going to be quite relaxed about repeatability. It's going to play an important role. And another reason why it's important, I think, not to hold on to it too dearly is that Ozawa in 1984 proved that there are no repeatable measurements for observables with continuous spectra. So that was a powerful result. I mean, you can still get pretty close, and there are various notions of approximate repeatability in the literature, starting, I think, with Brian Davies, but there's a zoo of them out there. I'll use one of them that I think is intuitively good. It's not that precise, but it'll be good enough, hopefully. So that's going to play an important role. So now we have the machinery. I'm going to talk about a specific measurement model that was written down by Wigner in 1952, 60 odd years ago, which incidentally is the same year he wrote his paper about with Vick and Whiteman about superselection. So they're obviously close in his mind, this topic and superselection rules when he was thinking about this stuff. But the idea is that we want to do a spin half measurement, of the x component of the spin of a spin half particle. So call it var phi plus or minus are just eigenstates of the spin along the x direction, and phi is just your ready to go pointer state. So a sensible guess or a naive measurement would just be one of this form. So the unit tree is implemented by the arrow, and all it does is preserves the x eigenstates, and these pointer states become orthogonal after the unit tree. So that's perfectly accurate in the sense that we're measuring a projection, and it's certainly repeatable because the SX eigenstates are preserved. So if you do another measurement, you'll get the same thing again. So it looks good. But if you write out, just expand in terms of eigenstates of the Z component of the spin, and then just use linearity to write out how these things evolve, it becomes immediately evident that the right-hand side contains the same amount of angular momentum. So in terms of the expectation value of SZ plus JZ, where JZ is just the sort of big angular momentum of the apparatus, but the left-hand side disagrees. So it doesn't matter how much this state has, these two differ by one unit in appropriate units. So this simple measurement scheme violates the conservation of the Z component of the angular momentum. So that's a problem. You could just say, well, it's a bad guess for the model. And in a sense it is, but I'll come back to argue that this is actually very general. And the reason for the violation, it's not totally obvious when you look at this why this happens, but it'll turn out that it really is because SX and SZ don't commute. So this is the kind of contradiction in the sense that it contradicts angular momentum conservation of a component of the angular momentum. So what Wigner did was he said, well, can we make the measurement worse in such a way that we can have approximate measurements with approximate repeatability properties, but still preserve the conservation law? So you just add in this eta, which is a sort of error term into the measurement model. Again, it has to be orthogonal, so we now have they span a three-dimensional Hilbert space. And what you find if you just apply the probability reproducibility condition is that you get two effects that are proportional to the projections onto the spin plus and spin minus in the x direction. But we have this proportionality term that has the norm squared of the error. So the game is to try to get this as small as possible, because if you do that, then you recover as good and as repeatable and accurate measurement as you possibly can. So the third POVM element is just a trivial one. It's just proportional to the identity. So we want to minimize the probability of getting that. This is just don't know what the outcome was, or don't know what the property was that we were trying to measure. And what Wigner showed all that time ago was that you can indeed make this norm small, but the price you have to pay is having a large number of terms in the basis expansion in terms of the z component of angular momentum, so the conserved quantity. So it's basically a large spread is what we're going to see soon in the conserved quantity. And if you do that, you can approximately recover the measurement that we had on the previous slide. So the kind of tagline is that if you have a large apparatus, or you need to have a large apparatus to get good measurements back again, good in the sense of accurate and repeatable. It's kind of vague, but I think hopefully this will become clear exactly that this is generic. Interestingly, this repeatability requirement was dropped by Wigner on the final page of his paper in 1952 with almost no explanation of why he was considering that or what the upshot was. But what happened was that he could recover perfectly accurate measurements without any size constraint. So again, this is looking like a theorem, and indeed it's true that this will be a theorem. So just to summarize what we saw in Wigner's paper is that accurate and repeatable measurements of the spin along the x direction violates the z component of the angular momentum conservation. So you can fix the conservation law, but then you lose accuracy and repeatability. You can drop repeatability, and you can have both accuracy and the conservation law. But this is going to come at a big price. So the price that has to be paid for that is that we have a pointer that doesn't commute with the conserved quantity either. So if there's a problem measuring observables that don't commute with the conserved quantities, then that's going to reappear at the level of the pointer when you try to measure that. So this is a big problem. So as Wigner noted, the measurement problem has basically been transferred from the system to the apparatus, and you still have to extract that information from the apparatus somehow. And this condition that the pointer observable commutes the conserved quantity, I'm going to refer to as the Yanasi condition, because he was the first guy to really take note of this as an important thing. Although he actually used it in order to find a lower bound for the accuracy, but certainly he was the first to notice that it was important. So this is indeed a theorem. So I think the Wigner paper is a nice example or a nice introduction to the theorem. But the theorem is powerful. It's totally model independent. It was proved in 1960. So we'll go to totally general notation. Just measure some self-adjoint operator M is what we're trying to do. And the conserved quantity is additive. And we'll just call it L1 plus L2. So the theorem, the Wey theorem, is, OK, there's a lot of words here, but we have, that's a mistake. I dropped the F, so forget about F. Let M be this measurement scheme. Assume the thing we're trying to measure is discrete spectrum and that the conserved quantity is bounded. So the conservation law is satisfied, and the theorem just states that if the measurement is repeatable or satisfies the Yanasi condition, the observable you're trying to measure has to commute with the conserved quantity. So that's totally in line with what we saw in Wigner's paper. So often this theorem is read backwards. So you try to measure some M that doesn't commute with the conserved quantity, then the measurement can't be repeatable and it can't satisfy the Yanasi condition. So that's the upshot of this theorem. The proof is actually quite simple. It's just a few lines, depending on the level of rigor you want to go to. Incidentally, you can weaken these conditions. So L2 doesn't have to be bounded actually, but see, yeah.
I was going to ask if L2 being bounded was effectively enforcing the fact that the pointer system was not infinite dimensional. Because if the pointer system is infinite dimensional, mm-hmm. you could do a perfect measurement on the system.
Yeah. You can incorporate the unboundedness. So I think this is a limiting case. So you can, in a limiting sense, you can recover perfect accuracy and repeatability in that case. Yeah. But it's
in that same limit, L2 doesn't become unbounded.
So the
question I was gonna ask you before you said you mm-hmm. generalize this unbounded was where yeah. in the statement of that theorem does the assumption that the pointer is finite dimensional come in?
Mm-hmm. So
your answer to that would be, maybe this has nothing to do with boundedness, but would you agree that if I don't have an assumption of finite dimensionality for the pointer, then I can't prove the theorem?
I think you can prove the theorem. Let me just think about that for a second. So I think what you get is when you just prove the theorem, you still get this kind of no-go part. I'm pretty sure, but what you find is that you can recover it in exactly the same large spread limit. You need the large spread limit to recover arbitrarily good measurements. I think that's what you see. So you find, I think, because it's about the preparation of the probe state as well as the boundedness of the apparatus.
So it seems to me that the only way to get arbitrarily large mm-hmm. spread is to have an infinite dimensional Hilbert space.
Yes.
So my impression is that in the limit of an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, there is no go.
There is a Go theorem as well, yeah. But I think it has to be thought of as separate from the, I mean, because, yeah, I mean, if you have access to infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces, then you do have these large spreads that you require. But you still have to find those states that will do it. So you can recover, to all intents and purposes, perfectly accurate and repeatable measurements. Yeah. But it's not repeatable in the strong sense. I think it's approximately repeatable, with the approximation becoming better and better as the spread gets bigger and bigger. So there is a definite go in that sense, but you still have to pay the same price. But maybe, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a necessary condition for arbitrarily good measurements that you have infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. So there have been various attempts in the literature to get around this that crop up from time to time, and they all boil down to pretty much the same example, which is the swap. So you just fix the dimensions to be the same. They can be as small or as large as you like, and you just have a unitary that flips the states of the system and the apparatus. It's obviously perfectly accurate because the state you're trying to measure just reappears on the right-hand side where the apparatus is, and it certainly respects the conservation law. That's simple to prove. But of course, it's totally in line with the theorem because it's not repeatable and it doesn't satisfy the Inarzi condition. These are both easy to see because it's not repeatable because the final state of the system doesn't depend on the initial one, so it can't be repeatable. And we're trying to measure some quantity that doesn't commute with a conserved quantity. So that just gets flipped over here, and we have a pointer that then doesn't commute with the conserved quantity. So the better thing to do, I think this is what Rob was asking about, is to hope for approximate accuracy with some price and good repeatability properties at the same price. And you can do it, but again, you need this large apparatus. And the larger the apparatus, the better the measurement you can do. And eventually, it's possible to get essentially perfect. I mean, this is a strange thing because, I mean, there are no repeatable measurements for continuous observables to start with. So all you can hope for is arbitrarily close to repeatable measurements. But you can do it. I mean, there are some models that I'm not going to be able to talk about, but they show this behavior in quite good, quite clear terms. But the interesting thing that I'm going to talk about is the case of position and momentum. So in that case, of course, we have infinite dimensions on the system and on the apparatus. So the proof of the theorem in the original style doesn't go through, partly because of this continuity of the spectrum. The continuous spectrum requirement means we have to give up repeatability, and partly because both system and apparatus have unbounded observables. So you can't do it in the way that Araki and Unazi did it. So it requires a very different approach. And the good way to do it is, I think, to study models. I'm not going to have time. There are two models that show exactly the right kind of behavior. One of them from Ozawa in 91, one of them in the monograph of Bush and Lati and Grabowski from 1997. But you can formulate these things in a model independent way, which I'm going to do here, and then talk about the consequences. So this is a slightly, I find this slightly ugly, I have to say, but it certainly gives some insight into what's going on. So we introduced this noise operator, which is a self-adjoint operator on the Hilbert space of the system and apparatus combined. And what it does is it compares the time-evolved, the Heisenberg time-evolved pointer observable with the position, which I'm going to write as Q, that we're trying to measure. You can do this in a generic way, but I'm just going to talk about position momentum. So I should give credit to Ozawa here. I think this formulation is due to him. Not in this case, but the idea of this trade-off is due to him. So I don't like it because it's a self-adjoint operator, but it's not really obvious that it's an observable in kind of the standard sense, because you're comparing operators at different times. But it's okay. it tells us something, certainly. So you just define the noise as basically some measure of spread of the noise operator. So just take the supremum over all input states of the system, gives you this state independent, at least independent of the state of the system, measure of the error of the measurement. So then you just apply the general uncertainty relation to the noise operator with the conserved quantity, and you get this thing here. So this is the expectation value of the commutator of the noise operator with the total momentum. So I'm suppressing tensor products all over the place. So I mean, of course, this really should be P tensor 1 plus 1 tensor PA, etc. And this is just the variance of the momentum, the total momentum. So the only way you can get an accurate measurement is if this thing is zero. So this gives us a good way of seeing when accurate measurements are possible. So of course, the nice thing is that if this is non-zero for any state of the system, then we have a limitation to the measurement. So implementing this important Unazi condition, we just get a commutator that's proportional to the identity. And that allows you to write down epsilon squared in exactly this way. So this term here is the spread of the momentum in the initial state of the apparatus. So we can see that as this goes to infinity, then epsilon goes to zero, which proves the necessity of large apparatus for good measurements. That was on implementing the Unazi condition. Obviously, if we violate it, go back to here, if we violate the Unazi condition, we can make the numerator vanish. So the Unazi condition plays the same role in the continuous unbounded case. And then I dreamt up a measure of repeatability, which is just like the noise operator. It just compares the time evolved observable you're trying to measure, which is the position, with the time evolved pointer observable. And you get exactly the same bound. So you can see that you can get good repeatability back with large apparatus in the same sense. So this is all talking about the spread of the momentum in the initial state of the apparatus. So I think this is bad for quantum information processing, in case that's something that people are worried about. I think it does cause a problem, because large apparatus means large spread of whatever it is that's conserved, which generally means that you're not going to be able to make things as small as you'd like, possibly. So the interesting thing, I think, about this is that we could say, well, why did we bother measuring Q? Why don't we just measure Q minus QA? Because Q minus QA is what we really measure anyway. it's a relative position. So again, I'm suppressing the tensor products. So it's Q tensor 1 minus 1 tensor QA. And I'm moving away from the kind of the measurement theoretic model here, because there becomes confusion of whether QA is an apparatus variable or a system variable, but I'm going to ignore that for now. But the point is that the numerator in 8, of course, vanishes if we measure Q minus QA. Because it commutes with the total momentum. So this QA is, in a sense, a reference system, I think. And it seems like we've managed to get around the way limitation by introducing a reference system. So you can play the game in various models of measuring Q and measuring Q minus QA, and what you find is the same behavior, that if the momentum is highly spread out in the QA system, then Q and Q minus QA become indistinguishable statistically. So for the first time, I'm going to talk about localization, because I think really what's going on is not the large spread in the conserved quantity, but high localization in the conjugate quantity that's the important thing. So of course, high localization in QA corresponds to a large spread in the momentum. And this actually shows up in all the models that I've considered. So you can do relative angle and total angular momentum, or you can even do number and phase, where phase is a covariant POVM. It's a phase observable conjugate to the number. And this always seems to be the localization in the conjugate quantity that allows good measurements. So we can view Q minus QA as a symmetrized version of Q. Symmetrized in the sense that now it's shift invariant. So these are just the momentum the shift generators generated by the momentum. So yeah, I'm getting close to the end, but this has a lot of stuff on it. So we can do this. So we had this relativization on the previous slide. We have a position and we turn it into a relative position or a difference observable. So what we're saying is that it's invariant under the action of some unitary group. So we'll go the other way and start with some unitary group that acts in the tensor product of the system and the apparatus combined. And we'll again assume that there's an additive generator, just in the same way that the momentum was additive. And the additivity just arises as this tensor product. And what you can do is, if you demand, or at least hope, that the observable you're trying to measure is symmetric, then you can actually construct any symmetric observable by using this gadget, which I'm going to accidentally refer to as yen, probably, because I called it that. It's the analogous to your dollar, I think, or the analog. Yeah. So what this is just the unitary that arises in here. And this is a covariant POVM on the Hilbert space of the apparatus, or of the reference system, if you want to call it a reference system. So this E of X take addition modulo 2 pi here. It's just a POVM that's this covariant under this group action. And you can find that this Y of A is symmetric for any self-adjoint operator A. So you take a group and you can find a bunch of symmetric observables generated from any observable A in the system. So this is a good map in the sense that it satisfies some good properties. It's positive, it preserves the unit, it's normal in the sense of maps between von Neumann algebras. But the interesting point is that if E is projection valued, actually you can even weaken that, but start with it being projection valued, then you can always find a sequence in the Hilbert space of the apparatus for which you recover the A statistics for all states. It doesn't have to be projection valued, it just has to be a POVM that satisfies the norm 1 property, which is a slightly technical condition, but it's the first weakening of projection valued measures that you can do, really. So, and the way that you do it is exactly by choosing these to be well localized with respect to E. So that's kind of interesting. But this is where super selection rules come in. So it seems like this behavior of having high localization in the reference system is generic. But of course, the oddity is that there's absolutely no reason that A has to be an observable. So if you have super selection rules, what you're saying is that there are some observables it's so tied that I call all self-adjoint operators observables. There are some self-adjoint operators acting in the Hilbert space of your system that are not observable. So that's the characterization of a super selection rule. But it doesn't stop you from forming an observable by taking Y of this operator. So super selection rules are manifested by some sort of invariance. In this sense, in this case, you demand that all observables you can measure are invariant under this group action. But as we saw on the previous slide, you can construct invariant observables from any operator in the Hilbert space of the system. So this brings reference systems into the game of super selection rules. And you can ask whether you can just take some non-observable of your system and relativize it in this appropriate way to get an observable. And then you can even apply this result here to recover all of the statistics of the thing that was not observable under the super selection rule in the first place. So this is a strange result. I'm not sure exactly how to interpret this, but hopefully we can discuss that at some point. Yeah. So there are some difficulties with this. One of them is exactly as you suggested, that the E in the defining condition here could be confined or constrained to a very low dimensional Hilbert space, in which case this localization is just not possible. So that's a problem. And another problem is that I think maybe it's not a huge problem, but in a sense, what this Y-map does on sharp observables, so self-adjoint observables, is relativize them. It relativizes the angle, it relativizes the phase if you pretend that it's self-adjoint. But it doesn't always give you this difference observable. It always gives you something symmetric, but it doesn't always give you something that's just a difference operator. So talking about that as system and reference maybe isn't the right way to think about it, but I'm not sure. So time for the summary. So we've seen that conservation laws certainly do limit quantum measurements in the sense of the Wigner-Araki-Yanasi theorem, but they don't preclude them in the sense that approximately accurate measurements with approximate repeatability properties certainly can be done. And that's in stark contrast to the super selection case where there are just no measurements. The Wey theorem does apply to position measurements that respect momentum conservation. That's another slight oddity because Ozawa wrote a paper suggesting that there was no Wey theorem for position momentum. But he'd already smuggled in this infinite dimensional Hilbert space and perfectly localized state. So then we moved to talk about the conservation law as a symmetry constraint and demanded that we measured only symmetric observables and found that you can still get very good measurements provided you have the availability of this localization condition with respect to the conjugate quantity to the conserved quantity. And the same thing seems to work for super selection rules, which to me is still, I'm not sure where that sits in my mind. There's plenty to do, I think. So on the super selection issue, there are lots of people who have constructed these things totally rigorously in algebraic quantum field theory. And as far as I'm aware, haven't talked about reference systems at all. So the question is there a role for reference frames there? And can you do this symmetrization or relativization in that context? Then there's this problem that I alluded to, that not all POVMs have this localization or localizability condition. And there are lots of other problems with super selection rules in general, which I haven't had a chance to go into. But what we were basically doing was applying the super selection rule at the global level of system and apparatus in combination, but not at the individual level of system and apparatus separately. Because if you did that, of course, this statistical recovery of the information about the non-observable would be meaningless, I think. So there's a question there about where to apply super selection rules. Then another question, of course, coming up in here is, should all observables be thought of as relative in any reasonable theory? And if you accept that maybe they should be, then relative to what is the question? I mean, position is naturally relative, so is angle, so is phase, but what about number, charge, etc.? So that's not obvious to me either. Then kind of a final point is whether the Weigh theorem really is a constraint in experiments, because if you can do this get out by relativization, it seems possible to me that maybe in some sense that's already happening in quantum mechanical interactions in the lab anyway. So I don't know if anybody's ever tested this experimentally. I'm not sure, but maybe it would be interesting. So yeah, that's it. Hopefully there are some questions. Okay, yeah, I mean these things like spin phase. So covariant POVMs that are covariant to some number-like observable, but confined to a low-dimensional Hilbert space. So in the sense that there's no, there we go. In the sense that there's just no state or sequence of states for which, I'm just talking about something simple like this, or maybe is approximately one. Yeah. For E of X, obviously non-zero, but also not the identity. So I mean, there are some POVMs that I think, I mean, that are certainly strictly less than one. And you can replace. I mean, even if you have a sequence, I think you still can't get it. So that's what I'm referring to.
Okay. So it seems to me there's maybe even a more basic question than the one you've written down there, which is.
Oh, so if
potential generalization of the Weigh theorem.
So if you're trying to measure a POVM of this sort, good question. good question. I'm not sure if that's been written down or not. I think not. Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Yeah.